as a new theory that tries to explain the relationship between the sun and our climate.
The year is 1801, and the Astronomer Royal, William Herschel, is quite fascinated by the matter of sunspots and their relationship to the price of wheat.
The fourth period on record is from the year 1695 to 1700, in which time no spot could be found on the sun. The average price of wheat in these years was £3, 3 shillings, and threepence the quarter. The five preceding years give £2, 9 shillings, and fourpence, and the five following years give £1, 17 shillings, and 11 pence. These differences are both very considerable.
In other words, the more spots there were on the sun, noted Herschel, the lower the price of wheat. Fewer sunspots and higher wheat prices, suggesting that growing conditions on Earth were being affected by the activity of our nearest star, that our weather depends on the sun's natural variability. Sure, humans are contributing to global warming through their car and factory emissions. No one disputes that. But the sun also varies of its own accord and affects our climate. And no scientist can say for sure exactly how it does so, and by how much.
First of all, it is an established fact that it is getting warmer. The question, of course, is why is it getting warmer?
There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that the sun is also part of this story. But what we can't say is how big a fraction is caused by the sun. I mean, my own belief is that it's much larger than we might think.
The actual existence of solar variability affecting the climate is, in my opinion, scientifically indisputable. We just have to go after it and find out what's actually causing it.
And that's the problem we'll be tackling in this program. How exactly does the sun affect our climate? We know it does, but the precise mechanism, the exact contribution of the sun to climate change, is a controversial area of research. In the eye of the storm is Professor Henrik Svensmark of the Danish Institute for Space Research, who, 6 years ago, came up with a provocative theory. At first, he was stigmatized by the scientific establishment, many of whom refused to take him seriously, especially since he wasn't a meteorologist at all, but a physicist.
I knew that people have been seeing correlation between solar activity and the climate on the Earth. I mean, I knew that many people dismissed it as being completely accidental. However, when I looked at the correlations at that time, I thought that it was too much to be merely accidental. At least one could consider what could the mechanism be. Then one day there had been a talk at the Institute, but there were some Russians discussing the idea that cosmic rays might change the transparency of the atmosphere by changing what they call nitrogen chemistry. I thought it was fairly complicated. But as soon as I heard the idea of the cosmic rays, my mind went back to high school when I saw this cloud chamber, where you saw these strikes of small droplets being formed with an ionizing particle went through. So I thought, well, why not ionizing particles changing clouds? And if you change clouds, it would be a very effective way of changing the energy that reaches the Earth's surface.
Henrik Svensmark believed he'd discovered a mechanism to explain the link between solar variation and climate change. The idea was that variation in solar activity acts on climate indirectly through its effect on cosmic rays hitting the Earth at the end of their journey across our galaxy. The more cosmic rays reaching Earth, the more clouds would be formed, and therefore the cooler the climate. When solar activity is high, the Earth is partially shielded from cosmic rays, but when the sun's activity declines, the influence of cosmic rays increases. And this, believes Svensmark, is what cools the Earth. Now, the whole theory turns on the ability of cosmic rays to activate cloud formation. Can they do this? And if so, how?
Cosmic rays are not really rays. It is particles, and it's mainly protons, so it's the most fundamental element that we have, and they are produced when big stars enter their life in a big explosion. that makes it
like a supernova, that sort of thing.
It's really a supernova explosion.
So these protons come whizzing out.
Right? Yeah, they're accelerated in the fields in this. I mean, it's like a huge accelerator. But they are important in this context that we are talking about because they actually ionize the atmosphere.
And that's the crucial mechanism that might enable clouds to form, ionization. When the particles that constitute cosmic rays collide with the molecules that make up the atmosphere, they give them either negative or positive electrical charge. These charged atmospheric particles become, the theory runs, the nuclei of tiny droplets of water that go on to form clouds. To test the idea, Professor Svensmark uses some apparatus well known to physicists, a small transparent-sided box containing atmospheric gases through which natural cosmic rays are allowed to pass.
Well, Henrik, you've just opened a door and I can see in front of me an illuminated, what looks like an illuminated aquarium, little tank of some kind with some swirling particles. What do we have here?
Well, this is actually a cloud chamber. And the sole purpose of this is actually to demonstrate the presence of ionizing particles, that is the cosmic rays that comes from outer space and how they ionize. You can't usually see them by the naked eyes, but inside this chamber there's a very special preparation where we get a very high supersaturation of is actually alcohol.
What do you mean by supersaturation?
Well, it means that that it sort of spontaneous condenses into a droplet of alcohol.
Right, so this, oh, so we've got this stream of droplets really,
yes,
right across.
We have the vapor that is sort of falling down through the chamber, yes, and because it's very cold in the bottom and warm in the top, so as soon as a particle goes through, it makes a lot of ions along a more or less straight line, and then we are seeing them in this little chamber here.
Oh yes, there are quite a lot of them, aren't there? So this is really basically a simulation of what could be happening in the upper atmosphere when cosmic rays from the galaxy strike the upper atmosphere.
Yes.
So basically what you're saying is that you've got the conditions and you've got a theoretical mechanism for forming clouds through cosmic rays.
We certainly have some ideas now, and these are now ideas that are so developed that we can start testing them in the laboratory.
There's now a great deal of very strong scientific evidence showing that there's a very large effect of solar variability on climate change, but we just don't know what the mechanism is. So the observation of Svensmark, I think, was a key clue.
Jasper Kirkby is a physicist at CERN, the European Particle Physics Research Centre in Geneva, where he's become an enthusiastic supporter of Svensmark's unusual idea. He stresses the huge role played by clouds in the Earth's climate and likes the notion that tiny ionized particles caused by cosmic rays might grow into larger aerosols in the atmosphere to form the core of cloud droplets.
If you actually increase the number of aerosol, these cloud condensation nuclei, then what you do is you don't increase the amount of water vapor in the sky, but you actually distribute it over more droplets and smaller droplets. So the amount of liquid water is the same, but they're spread out over more droplets. The net effect is, by doing that, that the cloud actually lives longer because it doesn't rain out so easily. The smaller droplets don't sediment out so quickly. It's also brighter, it's more reflective, so it very much affects the radiative energy balance on Earth. So the bottom line is changing the concentration of these particles can have a very big effect on clouds, and clouds are recognized as having an enormous effect on the radiative energy reaching the Earth.
Well, Henrik, now we're on a different scale altogether. We've come into a clean room. We're wearing one piece all over suits. We've got shoe protection. We've got hats on. This is obviously a work in progress. And a much bigger scale, as I say. What have we got in front of us here?
Well, this is actually what you call a large reaction chamber. And this is where we're going to test these ideas, whether ions are important for the formation of aerosols.
It's about 2 meters on square, is it? Something
yes,
like that?
It's really
it's
a
quite
cube.
Big. It's a cube. And it's dressed in polythene at the moment. But that will come away when the thing is put together. Right. So inside this will be air. It will be normal, regular atmosphere. And
yes.
Through it you will pass a, a controlled flux of cosmic radiation?
There will be a flux of ionizing particles, and I mean, what's really special about it is that we know the composition of what's inside. That's the difficult part.
There are plans to scale up this bigger experiment even further, using a particle accelerator at either CERN or Stanford University in the US. So far, though, the necessary funding hasn't been made available. We'll need to wait a while for conclusive laboratory observations to see whether the cloud seeding theory really holds water. Meanwhile, researchers are working on other ideas to explain how variation in solar activity could affect climate. Not far from Henrik Svensmark's office in Copenhagen is the laboratory of astrophysicist Dr. Peter Thiel of the Danish Meteorological Institute. Whereas Svensmark's theory describes an indirect way in which the sun might affect climate, Thiel's observations are more direct. He's trying to quantify the variation in the energy output from the sun itself, its brightness or radiance.
We're involved in analyzing a set of data that starts in the 1950s. It's called reanalysis data. It's a way of interpolating the very spotty observations. You have aircraft, you have balloons, you have ships moored at sea, you have little white sheds on the hillsides where people have been measuring numbers. All of those occur at different times and at different places, and they're not evenly spaced. You can interpolate that with a big model. That'll give you a nice, smooth data set that, in this case, now exists for 50 years. We've looked in that. It describes the entire lower atmosphere, temperature, winds, pressures, humidity, and things like that. And in that data set, we have removed some sources of variability, like the volcanoes. So we've removed the effect of volcanoes. We've removed the effect of the El Niño, which is a large internal oscillation in the climate system. We take all that out of the data. What we are left then with is possible effects of greenhouse gases, possible effect of the sun. Now, because the greenhouse effect probably is a smoothly increasing effect, we also take that out by removing the trend in the data. So we should be left with something that is just influenced by internal variability, which we cannot control, and the solar influence. And we see a strong, clear solar signal in those data, in the temperature, in the pressure at the surface, in the winds, the circulation system, changing its behavior in time with the solar cycle, which to us is a sign that it's caused by the solar cycle.
The initial results from observations of solar radiation and its effects over the past century are convincing, but not conclusive, because, as Peter Thiel was quick to point out, climate on a global scale is so complicated that it's very hard to be sure of anything.
It's complex, meaning all the parts interconnect. And that's why so many results from statistical research into the sun-climate connection have produced confusing results. Because one person would say, look, we can show it gets warmer in Bristol or something like that. And another chap says, no, it gets colder in Berlin. But wait a minute, they might both be the same phenomenon.
Well, I'm now on my way back from Copenhagen to London, and I was thinking as the plane broke through the somber low cloud over the city into the brilliant sunshine above, I was thinking how easy it is to imagine the importance of clouds in affecting the climate below. But not everyone has confidence in Henrik Svensmark's theory. Peter Thiel is more concerned with the direct effects of solar radiance on climate, for example. And Professor Joanna Haig at Imperial College, where I'm making for now, well, she needs a bit more to convince her that galactic cosmic rays really do act on our atmosphere to form the seed beds of clouds.
There's two problems with this theory, really. One is that the analysis of the existing data is statistically not very robust.
Meaning? Sounds like a euphemism for a bit flaky.
Yes, it's a bit flaky. I mean, as in a lot of atmospheric physics studies, there's just not long enough or good quality enough data for us really to be able to say, you know, to put our fingers on precisely what the mechanisms are.
So that's a sort of statistical and analytical drawback, you think.
Yes.
What was the other drawback?
The other drawback is the actual physical or chemical mechanisms. Now, it's quite plausible that cosmic rays do ionize the atmosphere, and it's quite plausible that the ionization can affect aerosol formation, that's the formation of tiny particulates in the atmosphere. But in order for them to produce cloud, these very tiny particles need to coalesce and expand until they become large enough to become cloud condensation nuclei. And the mechanisms involved in each of the stages in that chain is not established either in the atmosphere or in the laboratory.
One of the things I notice that is often said that there's no mechanism, that it's just a correlation. That isn't actually true.
Professor Mike Lockwood, a solar physicist at Rutherford Appleton Laboratory.
There are scientists who have proposed quite viable mechanisms that's based on good, understandable physics that will actually allow these cosmic rays to seed clouds. The difficulty, I think, is one of the scale of those mechanisms, of how effective they are. But it's certainly not impossible or implausible. It's a question of whether it really matters compared to other things that are going on.
So what do we have here, Mike? Do we have a number of competing theories or plausible hypotheses, or do we have a suite of causes that could all be operating to modulate the effects of our solar?
Well, that's an interesting question. One of the reasons you sometimes get enduring debates in science, in particularly in geophysics and these sort of areas, is that actually, yes, all the mechanisms are right, and it's a question of fitting them together like a jigsaw, and then every scientist can actually be right with his theory, and it's not that it's wrong, it's just a question of which one is the most important. And there is a distinct possibility that these things are acting in concert. What we do know from our reconstructions of how the sun's brightness has changed, and then looking at what we really would like the sun to have done to explain the global temperature responses here on Earth, is we do find that there seems to be an amplification factor. There seems to be something that makes this very small effect, a few tenths of a percent of the brightness of the sun, have more effect than it should do in our climate. It seems to be that the changes in the temperature of the sun cause a temperature change here on Earth that's about three times larger than we'd have expected.
So the sun's radiance varies very little, only by one-tenth of a percent or so. But here on Earth, we experience far greater temperature variation. Mike Lockwood hints at some as yet unidentified amplification mechanisms that could boost the sun's effects. One could be Henrik Svensmark's galactic cosmic rays, driving cloud formation. Another could be a phenomenon that fascinates Joanna Haig, what you might call the UV factor.
The sun has a spectrum which peaks in the visible, and that's why most of the radiation we get at the surface is in the visible. But it also extends right from X-rays through to the far infrared. And when the sun's more active, the spectrum changes too. And if you look over the 11-year solar cycle, we find that the total radiant energy coming out of the sun only varies by about a tenth of a percent. However, if you look in the ultraviolet, the further into the ultraviolet that you go, the larger the changes are. So if you look around 300 nanometers, which is just into the UV, we find that it's a few percent changes in ultraviolet radiation coming into the Earth. Now, that may not sound very large, but of course it's much larger than a tenth of a percent. And if you go shorter wavelength still, you can even get a factor of two changes over the 11-year solar cycle.
So we're talking about 10, 20, 30 times as much as the total energy coming out.
Yes.
To test her theory, Joanna Haig feeds all the available data on the sun's radiation into a powerful computer in order to simulate or model what seems to be going on.
The interesting thing about the results that I've been getting is that in terms of the effects lower down in the atmosphere, they're not at all uniform. So you might expect that if extra radiation came in from the sun, then everywhere would just get warmer. But it doesn't happen like that at all. What happens is that the circulation patterns change, and you can get much larger effects in some places than you do in others. So it depends where you live on the Earth, how much you'd see the effect of the sun.
This is in the computer. Is that reflected in data from the real world, then?
Well, the exciting thing that we've found recently is we've been analysing some climate data, and we get remarkably similar patterns from the observed data than we do from the models. Much more similar than you might expect. Might just be luck. We'll see.
Joanna Haig, along with Drs. Kirkby, Cheel and Svensmark, forms part of a small dedicated coterie of scientists gradually making progress on the links between our sun and our climate. Just 5 years ago, this was a Cinderella branch of the whole subject. Recently, though, the distinguished American journal Science identified Svensmark as among 2003's most exciting researchers, one to watch. But although some of the stigma surrounding this area is fast disappearing, controversy, both scientific and political, remains.
It's very different from what I did before. I was an astrophysicist before and did very mainstream research on stars and stellar models and the age of the universe and things that are completely mainline in astrophysics. And then I came to this field where the minute you say anything about the sun and climate, there are five new headlines and newspaper stories and angry people phoning you up and saying, "Oh, what do you mean? You shouldn't have said that," and so on. So it's a very different field. People notice it.
But if we really want to understand the vagaries of our atmosphere, we need to take account of the part played by the sun's natural variability. We need, says Mike Lockwood, a deeper understanding of the solar powerhouse to give us a scientifically global view of global climate.
To start with in the century, it was solar-induced change, that the warming that we saw between, say, 1900 and 1940 or so was actually largely induced by changes in the sun. But from 1970 up to the present day, there is not really much credible doubt that the dominant warming is anthropogenic, it's man-made greenhouse gases. And what makes the last 150 years interesting is the transition from one into the other. And really, the only factor that will really come to counter that will be the long-term cycles of climate change caused by our Earth's orbit around the sun, which tell us that we are, the present warm period, the Holocene, we're reaching the end of. Statistically, it shouldn't last too much longer, and we will be plunged into an ice age. And In those terms, the global warming greenhouse effect is actually negligible. So we will go into an ice age whether we warm it up first or not.
Discovery was presented by Peter Evans and the producer was Sue Broom. And in next week's Discovery, Peter will be looking at the malaria parasite that's responsible for more than a million deaths across the globe each year.
150 years ago, the great explorer Captain Richard Burton travelled the 3,000-kilometre length of Brazil's treacherous São Francisco River. So which of Burton's many qualities most helped him on his journey? His mastery of disguise, his many languages, his horsemanship, or his pistol aim? This month, the BBC's Paulo Cabral retraces Burton's route, recording his own 21st century impressions of the activity along its banks. What will he see? Who will he meet? And what treasures will he find? You can follow Paolo's journey through his weblog at bbcworldservice.com. And why not send Paolo your personal suggestions of where he should visit? Just log on to bbcworldservice.com and look for blogging in Brazil. Join the adventure all this week.
After the news summary in the next episode of Westway, Mike wants to talk money with Margaret. Why is he so interested in her finances? And Sean feels guilty for denying all knowledge of Gary's whereabouts, but can he break his promise to keep it secret? That's Westway. And then in a quarter of an hour following that, Heart and Soul this week looks at another family dilemma as part of a series examining a range of painful choices faced by families. All to come in a couple of minutes.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. The British Defence Secretary Geoff Hoon has said that many thousands of extra troops are available for deployment in Iraq if necessary. Mr. Hoon was speaking after two incidents on Tuesday in which six British military policemen were killed and seven soldiers wounded. He said an urgent review had to be conducted to find out what happened and who was behind the attacks. The United States government has ordered an improvement in security at its nuclear weapons laboratories in response to a series of security lapses. A U.S. Senator, Chuck Grassley, said American nuclear secrets were not safe.